Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
What can we take away from a magazine's archives that span 165 years? And why was it so important for The Atlantic to digitize those archives? Those are a few of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. So let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in-depth with media leaders and newsmakers, talking about the story behind the story and about how the media world works. The Atlantic, of course, is one of the most prestigious magazines in the media world. It has been published since the years before the Civil War. But until recently, those archives, all of that content from 1857 up until 1995, was barely accessible, was not online on theatlantic.com. So the magazine has changed that. It has now provided the incomplete archives, the good, the bad, the ugly, the impossible to read. And as you're about to hear, it has opened up new avenues for readers. And while we're talking about The Atlantic, it's been in the news for other reasons recently, including for editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg's striking story relating to the new movie Where the Crawdads Sing. I always enjoy talking to Goldberg on TV, on Sunday's Reliable Sources. There's always so much more I want to ask him, so I invited him here on the podcast to talk about the archives, his new reporting, and the state of The Atlantic and the magazine business more broadly. So let's get to it. Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We should begin at the very, very beginning, since we're talking about the archive. Take us back to the founding of the magazine. What were the creators of The Atlantic trying to do?
The creators of The Atlantic were trying to do two things. And here we're talking about people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Longfellow, Oliver Wendell Holmes, a lot of people with complicated facial hair and three-part names, except for Harriet Beecher Stowe, who did not have complicated facial hair. They met in Boston in May of 1857. The magazine world at that time was in ferment, and a lot of these guys thought that magazines were the way to communicate to the mass public. The idea was twofold. Well, threefold, actually. One was to supplant British literature, have Native American, not Native American in the current sense of the term, but American-born writers of literary note have a platform to be seen. We had in this country in the 1850s, 40s, a kind of chip on the shoulder attitude about the primacy of British literature. So there was that. They were all abolitionists, and they were all supportive of the immediate end of slavery. Many were supporters of John Brown, actually. They were quite radical. So abolitionism was the cause, if you will. There was also another thing with the most complicated part of this and the most interesting part in some ways. They believed that America needed a magazine that would express the American idea. And in their opening manifesto, they said, we are going to be the vehicle for the American idea. But they didn't define the American idea. And I've always taken that to mean that each generation of editors, journalists, is there to sort of figure out what is the American idea, what streams of different thought processes lead to a kind of coherent American idea. And so, you know, The Atlantic at its best for the last 165 years has been trying to explain America to itself in a lot of ways. And that's what you're going to. That's what you're going to find in the archives. You're going to find a lot in the archives, but that's something in, you know, nice quantity.
1857 through 2022. Yeah. When you go back to 1857, what stands out to you most about those initial issues? Do we even call them issues back then?
They were made on paper. They weren't carved in stone. It's not that long. Okay, one of the things that's so interesting is that most of the pieces aren't readily understandable. In other words, decontextualized, they're very, very hard to understand. References are completely obscure. It takes some matter of research to figure them out. You know, this was an age in which people would use 15 words when two would suffice. So so a lot of this stuff is quite intricate. A lot of the material is quite intricate. On the other hand, the best pieces, the pieces that really, you know, you take to, I mean, Longfellow's, you know, Paul Revere's Ride was published in The Atlantic. The Battle Hymn of the Republic was published as a poem on the front page of The Atlantic in 1862. Frederick Douglass on Reconstruction and Universal Suffrage. Ralph Waldo Emerson's pieces are very clear. It's actually interesting to read certain pieces. Nathaniel Hawthorne, the obviously the great novelist, Scarlet Letter, and so on, was the Atlantic Civil War correspondent, and his copy is very clean and very accessible. It's very interesting. So you're going to toggle back and forth between things that you have no idea what they're talking about and material that seems as modern as today. Really remarkable.
What does that tell us about writing? What lessons should we learn from that as writers?
It's never a bad idea to cut words. What does it tell us? I mean, there was a style. The funniest example of this to me is the 1860 endorsement of Abraham Lincoln by the editors of The Atlantic. What's so amusing about the endorsement editorial is that Abraham Lincoln is only mentioned at about the 4,000th word.
Incredible.
So, people accuse magazine writers of doing excessive throat clearing today, but, we're a lot better. We got a lot better than it used to be.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, when it gets to the point, it gets to the point, but it takes a while to get to the point.
Are there pieces in the archive that you hesitated to digitize?
Well, yeah, let me break down that question. There's nothing that we hesitated to digitize because we made a commitment that no matter how weird, discordant, racist, misogynist, whatever unpleasantness we were going to confront in the past, we were going to publish it all because this is an historical record, right? It's the good, the bad, the ugly, the ridiculous, the sublime. And so, you know, of course, despite the fact that The Atlantic has been associated, or let's say in the old days, it was associated with the progressive movement as we understood it then. And obviously it was an abolitionist magazine, published W.E.B. Du Bois against imperialism at a time when no one was doing that, and so on and so forth. There are still, you know, incredible, moments of stories. There's still credible stories in there that just ring really terribly. But that's just what you have to do. There's a piece, I refer to this in my note to the readers about this. There's one of my favorite, in scare quotes, favorite pieces. It's from 1939, in fact. It was called, the headline was called, "I Married a Jew" by Anonymous. And it's by a German-American woman who declares herself to be a sympathizer of Hitler in many ways, but nevertheless married a Jewish guy and is explaining what it's like to be married to a Jew. I mean, there are pieces along the way that, you know, make you laugh, make you, you know, sort of sit back in horror. And they're all mixed up together. You know, there was one of the editors in the past was a pretty severe immigration restrictionist and wrote a poem in opposition to Emma Lazarus, right? And when I first learned of that, I thought, you know, too bad we didn't get the Emma Lazarus poem. Too bad we got this one. But you know, it's all there. It's a reflection of what people were thinking about and talking about in America at whatever moment you're diving into. And it wouldn't be fair to the readers. It wouldn't be fair to historians and researchers and students. It wouldn't be fair to the truth to cut out stuff that's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyway, it's not embarrassing. When it's embarrassing is what you publish by mistake. Embarrassing is not what someone who's been dead for 90 years published by mistake.
Mm-hmm. Right. How much of a Herculean effort was it to digitize these archives? I have to be honest, I was sort of surprised they weren't already online when you all shared this week that they were now finally online.
By the way, so was I when I got to the Atlantic. It was just one of those projects that was sort of too big to swallow. But you know, my argument and Nick Thompson's argument, our CEO, to do it was that you do it exactly once, right? You don't have to ever do it again. So the cost associated with it, and all the rest, these are one-time costs. And one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to guide people through it. So we have bios of 25 of our most famous writers and selections of their writing. And we're trying to organize it so that people can kind of visit and not just get lost in the thickets. They can go to a Frederick Douglass landing page. They can go to a Mark Twain landing page and see what they wrote for the Atlantic, Sylvia Plath's poetry and Helen Keller's essays and all the rest. You can find those easily. And so, you know, we also think, and I don't want to sound commercial at all here, but we also think that quite obviously people will come to these pieces forever. So it's great to introduce people to the Atlantic, you know?
It's another side door.
Yeah, it's another side door. It's all side doors, as you know, and so it's another side door.
I've always been happy that CNN has decades of transcripts of shows up on CNN.com. I don't know if anybody knows that they're there, but I find it really valuable to be able to go back and see what was being said on reliable sources 20 years ago. Certainly CNN, not nearly as historic as The Atlantic, but the records have a meaning that sometimes you won't even know when you're the one digitizing it, right? Like, I don't think the people that started posting transcripts on CNN.com know that I'm finding that useful 20 years later. You know, right. So it goes in unexpected directions.
Right. I mean, I think the people who did it probably thought somebody's going to find this useful at some point. And by the way, as more and more time goes by, let's say when reliable sources is 100 years old, you know, people will be writing PhD dissertations on the conversations that you have this year. Part of being an advanced civilization is that we record what we've done as we're doing it. And we leave a record so people can interpret the past honestly and fully. And so that's the reason to do this. And by the way, maybe three people will read a certain piece in any given decade. But you know what? Those three people needed that piece and they might actually learn something and illuminate something for readers of the future. So it's great. It's all good.
What's the project that you all are doing now to highlight some of the gems in the archive?
It's mostly focused around writers right now, but you know, we're thinking about, and again, you know, the difficult part was getting this all up. You know, like literally we've loaded millions upon millions of words onto the internet, onto our site in the last couple of months to get it ready, right? And we're, you know, honestly, we're still spell checking, you know. So there's some basic things that have to be done to make sure that quality is imposed on the archives and that we treat it with the respect that it deserves. We have these author pages. We're organizing ourselves. We've had some of the great writers in American history. I mentioned a few already, write for The Atlantic. Hemingway's first short story was in The Atlantic. And so we want people to know that. But what I'm interested in also is organizing this by theme. In other words, we've done in the past a Civil War special print issue, a World War I special print issue, an MLK issue. I want to take that to the digital realm also and organize around great themes. Immigration is sort of an obvious one right now. Women's rights is a very interesting one. The Atlantic always published a large number of women writers, even back in the day. The Atlantic, most of the writers of The Atlantic were suffragists, and there's some very interesting material there. So we want to make it understandable. Right now it's a museum, and most everything is just piled on top of each other. And we want to sort of label things so people can find them. And I think doing it by the great themes of American history and world history, obviously, makes a lot of sense. But, you know, this is going to be a forever project, which is sort of exciting.
Yeah. What's your advice to other publishers, other editors who are thinking of trying to do the same thing you all just did?
you actually just gave me an interesting idea or an interesting insight into this, which is that a lot of people don't understand why you would do this or why you would spend the money. I have a friend, Hussein Haqqani, who is a former Pakistani ambassador to America. He once said something that really stuck in my mind. He said, only in America does the expression "that's history" mean that's irrelevant, right? We're always focused on the future, and especially in the last 20 years, we're focused on our digital future, you know, and legacy publications like The Atlantic were thought to be, you know, pleasant, you know, sort of museum pieces of the past. Turns out not true at all. What I would say to publishers today is that you have no idea what value lies in putting everything that you have up in the public record. You don't, in other words, use a transcript of your show from 3 years ago might not be particularly valuable, might not provide someone with extraordinary insight into America in that period. But believe me, 25 years from now, it's going to be more valuable, and 50 years and so on. And I think this is true for any publisher. It doesn't have to be just the magazine of the American Idea or CNN, a global news gathering network. It can be small publications that are specialized, different areas. Everybody should do this. You have no idea what value you're going to bring to the future by doing this. And again, you know, on a practical level, it's a cost, but it's a one-time cost.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Frederick Douglass is going to, you know, he's been doing great things for us lately. But other than that, do people still get that joke, or is that like a 5-year-old Trump joke now? At this
point? I still get it, but I don't know if I'm the best person to.
Yeah. You might be over-informed. but the point is that, you know, and also I think students, high school, college, PhD, they could all use this stuff. And it's remarkable. And, you know, there was a period in TV where early TV, where a lot of stuff was thrown out, and it's a damn shame. And we have to save. We're not going to know ourselves if we don't know what we thought 10, 20, 30, 100 years ago.
All right, well, let's go from the past to the future. There's a lot more to talk about involving The Atlantic. Quick break here, and then more with Jeffrey Goldberg on the Reliable Sources podcast.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, an occasional author for The Atlantic, actually more than occasionally. Your latest piece, Jeffrey, is titled Where the Crawdads Sing, Author Wanted for Questioning in Murder. Now, I was not familiar with this. I think a lot of people are coming to this with a relatively little background knowledge, but the movie, Where the Crawdads Sing, is in theaters this weekend. It's opening wide. It's a big deal. It's based on an incredibly successful book. But before the book Take us back in time and tell us why you could write about anything, and you've got a very busy day job editing the magazine. Tell me why this was important for you to write about.
Well, you know, for 30 years I was a magazine writer, and then I became a magazine editor. You know, so my heart is in my heart is still in the writing in a lot of ways. It turns out that I love editing. I didn't know that at the time, but so 12 years ago I published when I was actually I had already left the New Yorker for the Atlantic, but the Atlantic very graciously let me finish a piece that I had been working on for a couple of years for the New Yorker. And it was a very long investigation of this couple, Mark and Delia Owens, who were pretty famous American conservationists in Africa. They wrote a very best big book, Cry of the Kalahari. Some people might remember that. They were in that group of people, including, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, Joy Adamson, you know, the generally speaking, white Americans who go to Africa to save animals, that camp. But what happened, and this is quite complicated, I'll try to boil it down to its essence, is that ABC News show called Turning Point, which is one of their news magazine shows in the 90s, I guess, hosted by Diane Sawyer, did an hour-long special on the Owenses and their work in Zambia, in a park called the North Luangwa National Park. They were fighting poachers at the time. And I hadn't seen The Turning Point when it came out. I think it was broadcast in 1996. I didn't see it, but I was talking to people a couple of years later, people involved in conservation, and they said, you know, they were referring to, in shorthand, the ABC snuff film. And I was like, what are you talking about? I saw the documentary, and it was unbelievable, because in this documentary, they show the execution of a helpless person on the ground, identified as a trespasser. At the execution of this person, the gun was fired from off camera, so you don't see who fired it. And it was done as this is the price poachers pay. There was no evidence that the guy was a poacher. But I don't think at that point I had ever seen, and this is a hard thing to see, I don't think I had ever seen an actual murder committed on camera. This wasn't just a guy being shot as he's running toward them, shot in self-defense. He was literally on the ground, bullets are fired, and then he's still. And so that got me, you know, and then like a lot of magazine writers, I'm down the rabbit hole, right? And I'm trying to figure out what's going on in this story. And it turns out that there's a kind of a Heart of Darkness quality to this story. Mark Owens, in particular, and with Delia and with Mark's son from a first marriage, Chris Owens, basically became the rulers of this vast swath of very remote Zambia. 2,400 square mile park, very little government oversight. What they brought to the park was money and guns and equipment. So they turned the nominally government scouts into their own scout division, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll have to go back and it's 18,000 word story in the New Yorker. You'll have to go back for all of the details to that. It's on their website. And I just wrote sort of a pressy of it for The Atlantic this week. But basically, one could say that maybe they became a little power mad. And Mark, in his effort to protect the elephants, admits in a letter to a game park operator or a concession owner that his scouts had already killed two poachers and were, quote, just getting warmed up. There were a lot of accounts of physical abuse, a lot of accounts of very, very strange behavior culminating in this murder, right? Culminating in this murder. I did a lot of investigation. I talked to the ABC cameraman finally, who said that it was not a Zambian game scout who shot this guy on the ground. It was Chris Owens, the son of Mark Owens, white American on a tourist visa, right? And ABC covered it up. ABC completely covered this up. It has film of an American citizen shooting an unarmed Zambian and then executing him. And it buried that part of the story, but broadcast the story as if this person had been shot by a Zambian, right? A Zambian game scout. It is a very, very, very dark story.
And ABC, when you followed up with ABC, they've refused to share the full tape or address this. Is that right?
They refuse to address it in any. They basically wash their hands of the whole thing. The producer.
Now, is it possible they're just saying, "Hey, this was nearly two decades ago. Different leadership, different management, different producers." Is that their excuse?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was asking them 13 years ago, it wasn't two decades ago. But no, different producers. The show is gone. Meredith Vieira, who is the reporter on the ground, said, "I didn't know what was going on." Diane Sawyer had no idea what was going on. Everybody else had already gone from the network. The cameraman, this guy named Chris Everson, his conscience was bothering him. And he finally told me, he said, "Look, I filmed this. I filmed this guy, Chris Owens, shooting the guy." And I said, "Why didn't you go to the Zambian police?" And he said, "It was above my pay grade. I was just a contract cameraman for ABC. That was not my responsibility." And no one at ABC actually. What's so odd about this, Brian, from a journalistic perspective, is that they had a better story, right? The better story is this family going into the wilderness and establishing themselves as basically the rule of law. Julia Owens was intimately involved in establishing all of this. She wasn't there at the scene. But when I went back to Zambia a few weeks ago to sort of refresh the story, refresh my understanding of the story, and the chief prosecutor, the federal chief prosecutor, told me that it is an open case. There's no statute of limitations on murder. They want to question Chris Owens, Mark Owens, and Delia Owens. They believe that Delia Owens is at least a witness, if not an accessory after the fact. And they want to question her. They were very surprised, as a lot of people were, that Delia Owens had this second life. You know, I had so many years had gone by, I'd lost track of what had happened to them. And then all of a sudden, in 2018, I guess, 18, 19, I started getting pinged by people who were telling me, "Hey, do you know that Delia Owens has a best-selling novel on the list?" Then, of course, it was explosive. It was the best-selling book of the year. Witherspoon endorsed it. And then you have this movie. And what's so interesting to me, and you sort of said this yourself, this was an 18,000-word investigation in The New Yorker. Not exactly in an obscure magazine. Not exactly a small story, right? But so many people were surprised by this week when I put this out.
They were, yeah.
Atlantic, connecting it to the Crawdads book and movie. It just, I think it was Michael Kinsley who said that you should use everything you have as a journalist three times, because that guarantees that at least some part of the population will see it. I've been so surprised at how Delia Owens hasn't been forced by the publishing media, by the Hollywood media, to answer any questions about what happened in North Lwangwa National Park when they were there in the 90s. It's all, I mean, I have it all documented in the New Yorker story. It's not hard to find. And it's just one of the most amazing stories I've ever been involved with, because everything about it is Baroque. Everything about it is very dark and very Baroque. And it's really a white savior story in a lot of ways. It's white people going to Africa and deciding how they're going to save the animals. And in the course of doing that, Africans died. I think it deserves a lot more exploration as a specific story and as a general theme.
Mm. I mean, every time I check Amazon, the number one bestselling book on Amazon, on all of Amazon, is Where the Crawdads Sing by Julia Owens. And so have any of the Owens addressed these allegations?
Not recently. No, I met Delia. I went to her. They were living in remote northern Idaho at the time, after they had been basically forced out of Zambia, fled Zambia, left Zambia, knowing that they were wanted for questioning. They moved to northern Idaho. I found their ranch. I drove up. I doorstopped her, essentially. I said, "I'm Jeff Goldberg. I've been trying to report on you for a year now." She said some things, denied any responsibility for anything, and that's reflected in the stories. And said, I thought the most interesting line, she said, "Don't you understand? We were just trying to do good." And that really struck me. The other thing that strikes me about the story right now is that Crawdads, this is what people were pointing out to me when they were starting to email me a few years ago. Crawdads is about a young woman, a Southern loner who loves nature and is totally isolated from society, who in the course of protecting herself commits, and this is a spoiler alert, sorry, commits a murder. And throughout the book, there are all these references to people who worked for them in Zambia. There's all kinds of clues along the way that this book has a lot to do with her experience in Zambia. And again, she hasn't really addressed that quality of it. I found that very, very interesting. And I want to understand more about why she wrote this book the way she did. But from what I understand, she's canceling PR interviews now associated with the movie because of the story that I posted that reopened this subject this week. Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this at all to be critical, but you timed the story on purpose, you know, that revisiting Zambia again, publishing this week ahead of the movie's release, because
wait, you're suggesting that a journalist tried to time a story for maximum impact?
For maximum impact. That's right.
Is that what you're suggesting, Brian?
It gets to that great quote about you got to use what you have three times.
Well, it's not only that. No. I mean, let me not be cynical, because I'm not. First of all, I've been trying for months to get to Zambia, and I had an opportunity in January, but then COVID struck and we couldn't get there. I've been trying to get this thing done for a long time, and I was up against it. But no, I wanted to time it. I wanted to come out before the Crawdads movie so people know.
Yeah.
People have a right to know what the author of this film was alleged to be involved with. And they have a right to know that the book in many ways echoes some very strange happenings in Zambia a couple of decades ago. And, you know this, and we've talked about this in the past. People tend to think that journalists are more organized than they are and engage in elaborate plots and conspiracy. I mean, I was just, you know, I do have a day job, as you said, and I was just totally up against it. Finally, I snuck out to Zambia, which is not close to Washington, I should point out. Uh-huh. I finally snuck out about 3 weeks ago, met with the prosecutors and the police there, and they said, yeah, we're still on it. And that seemed to me newsworthy enough. Yeah,
that's news. Now, when they say they would still like to speak with the Owens, but as a practical matter, it's not happening, right? There's no extradition treaty between the two countries.
No, it's going to be very hard. I mean, and you know, it's not my place to say how the Zambians should do this. A couple of them told me that they were interested in trying to reconnect with the FBI, with the U.S. Embassy. The problem is and again, this is in the New Yorker piece, which I would point people to, along with the Atlantic piece. The problem is that the ambassador at the time they left was helping them leave, and that all of the American ambassadors who were there during their stay in Zambia were very much on their side. And there's quotes on the record, quotes defending the Owens, as one of the former ambassadors told me that he wanted actively to get Mark Owens out of Zambia because he thought that the Zambian police would arrest him and put him in a Zambian prison where he would be raped and be given HIV. That's the quote.
There's some subtext there.
So the U.S. Embassy was, let's say, at the time at least, not really interested in pursuing the investigation of what happened on that ABC tape. They were more interested in getting Mark and Delia Owens safely out of Zambia before they could be arrested.
Right.
I'm telling you, there's layers and layers and layers here.
There are.
The stories I've ever worked on.
And as a result of your piece, I mean, if you Google Dilly Owens' name now, there are article after article aggregating your reporting and making it more, even more prominent. And thus, sir, you're saying you've heard that she's been canceling some interviews.
I've seen that. I can't confirm that, but I've seen that from other journalists. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I refer to it as aggregating. I'm sure there's a new word we can come up with. Like anybody who writes something based on original reporting, it's always kind of a double-edged sword to see everybody sort of taking your material and reworking it. But on the other hand, I'm going to be honest here, perfectly honest, I'm glad that people are paying attention to this. It's a murder of an unarmed black man by a white American citizen who is visiting this person's country and shooting him to death. That's what the cameraman and that's what the Zambian police allege of documents that say that they believe that Chris Owens was the person who fired the fatal shot. There's no justice here. Hmm. I mean, so far, at least, there's no justice. This person was executed on the ground, allegedly by an American, and no one's been held to account. And ABC News witnessed this murder and has not in any way even acknowledged that it witnessed the murder and probably has tape with the unobscured face of the person who pulled the trigger. And that part is as, to me, frustrating as anything else, because I think there's an abdication of journalistic responsibility here.
Well, I like the way you put it, that they had a better story right in front of them.
Yeah. They had a much better story than just this kind of gooey, like, oh, look at these wonderful white people from Georgia who are going to save the elephants. You know, it's a much more complicated story than that and much more interesting than that.
Mm, it's wild. People should definitely read the Atlanta.com for your recent piece and then the older one on NewYorker.com. And of course, hey, the New Yorker Archive, same as the Atlantic. That brings us full circle.
The New Yorker Archive is also a delight, I have to say. Complete and total delight.
It does bring us full circle. Tell me about the state of the Atlantic more broadly. I have this impression from the outside that you all have been hiring up folks. You've been adding writers. You've been adding newsletter writers under your umbrella as well. So I have this from the outside that you're in a growth period. Is that accurate? And what's the strategy, you know, more broadly for the Atlantic in 2022?
I think that we're in a continual growth period. Growing goes slower and faster depending on the economy. I think, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people in the last few weeks and everybody's kind of agitated about where we are generally. But we are in a growth period. I'm trying to focus on 2024 as much as I can in terms of hiring and sort of a focus. I mean, you know this. We've talked about this in the past.
You mean hiring political reporters? What do you mean?
Hiring political reporters, but also, you know, looking across the landscape for people who are constitutional experts, people who are Supreme Court experts. I'm trying to find people. I mean, Tim Alberta, a relatively recent hire, is a case in point. You know, obviously great chronicler of the Republican Party for Politico, wrote a tremendous book about it. Just wrote in the not so distant past, maybe a couple of months ago, brilliant piece about the state of evangelical America.
Oh, and the
politicization. Yeah. You know, and what I'm trying to do in a pretty deliberate way is find the very best writers and reporters in America who can write at feature length to cover all aspects of our national nervous breakdown. And I'm very, very focused on 2024. We're focused on 2022 in the midterms, obviously. But I am where I've written this. I can say it, obviously. I want to make sure that 2024 is not our last Democratic election. And so we have, we just brought on Mark Leibovich, for instance, who has this new book out about the enablers, the Trump enablers. And so we have this wide variety of excellent writers. Elena Plott is coming back to us. She went to the New York Times for a couple of years, coming back to us next month, which I'm glad for. I want to have a staff that can cover all aspects of this, but in a deep explanatory way. You know, we're a magazine. We want to break news when we could break news, but we can do a greater service by explaining, contextualizing, going deep history, by using the power of feature writing and narrative to get people to understand the consequences. Bart Gellman, obviously 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner, who's written a couple of amazing cover stories for us on the threat to Democratic continuity. So this is a huge, huge focus of mine. It's very important, obviously, at a general interest magazine to have generally interesting stories for our readers. And so we're trying to cover all subjects. Obviously we did. And when I say we, I mean the excellent science and health teams that we have did amazing work on the pandemic. Ed Young won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his coverage of the pandemic, as you know. So we're focused on the news, but we're trying to go deeper than the news. And then we're never, and we can never forget that we're a magazine first, and that what we have to do is also provide illuminating and entertaining narratives to our readership, because that's why they pick up a magazine when they're sitting on the beach or when they're on the train. They want to read things that move them forward, that help them explain a subject that they maybe weren't even interested in before they picked up the magazine. So we have a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on.
Always looking around the corner, right? So your piece about the abortion underground months before Roe v. Wade overturned.
Yeah.
So you're helping people see into the future sometimes by looking into the past. When you say you want to make sure 2024 is not our last Democratic election, what's the best case outcome? What's the best case scenario? Is the best case scenario that we're going to look back in a few years and say, oh, that was a dramatic overstatement. Maybe that was an overreaction.
Yeah.
will you be happy if we look back and say, if we say that?
As a citizen and as a patriot, yes, I hope to God that we look back in 5 years and go, what was that all about? You know, and that.
Like we're all going to have democracy beats and we're going to hire democracy reporters. And yeah. I hope we can look back and say, you know what, that was all maybe an overstatement.
And we're going to transition those writers to the horticulture beat or something.
Perfect. Yes. I hope we can do that.
Yeah. But I don't think that's where we're heading. And, you know, one of the things we have at The Atlantic is a great core of writers who come out of conservative journalism. Tom Nichols, Pete Wehner, Caitlin Flanagan to some degree. She's so interesting. Her interests are so broad. But we have a lot of people who are disaffected conservatives, or let's say true conservatives, disaffected Republicans. And I talk to them all the time. Obviously, I pay close attention to what Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and everyone else is saying. I have eyes, right? And I have ears, and I know what's happening. You know, we talked about this on a past episode. I went down to the White House and the Capitol on January 6th to see what was going on. My vestigial reporting desires got the best of me. And I was very, very frightened when I, even at the White House rally, even at the White House portion, seeing guys in Kevlar and helmets, and you know that someone is up to no good. And I come away from this whole experience of the last 6 years thinking that democracy is much more fragile. Democracy, transparency, accountability, all of these issues are much more fragile than we thought. And, you know, I go back to something we talked about at the beginning. The Atlantic is a magazine of the American idea. The American idea is a democratic idea. How you get there, how you make a more perfect union, that's where it's interesting. That's where you want to have tumult and argument and fighting and different viewpoints. But America is a democratic experiment. And I think that many Americans have unlearned democracy or never learned democracy in the first place. And if we're going to fulfill our historic mission at The Atlantic, not to get all highfalutin, and sorry, it sounds pretentious, but if we're going to fulfill a mission here, then we're going to have to bear down on these questions past 2024, obviously, but leading up to 2024, absolutely. And so I keep a very, very steady focus on what we could be doing and what we can be saying and how we could be deploying these amazing writers and amazing editors that we have to tell our readers, to tell Americans and the world something new. I mean, look, we have Anne Applebaum, who's one of the great experts on Soviet communism and is doing remarkable work on Ukraine and democratic retrenchment. And I can't do enough. We can't do enough, is my view. We can't do enough.
Anything I say now is just going to take away from your tremendous message. So let me just say thank you. Thank you for the conversation today. And thanks for giving us so much to read.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for us here on the podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you on television this Sunday and every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. And make sure you're on the list for our nightly newsletter as well. You can sign up for free at reliablesources.com. Thanks for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.